Now, from the left coast, another in-depth interview from Peter B. Collins. Peter B.'s been talking about news and politics since Watergate and generously shares his knowledge, wisdom, opinions, and outrage here because his friends and family can't take it anymore. Peter B.'s an independent progressive who upsets Democrats and Republicans as conditions require and is one of the few lefty pundits who predicted Trump would win. This podcast is funded entirely by listeners like you, and subscribers get first access to these in-depth interviews. When you're ready, go to peterbcollins.com/signup. Now, here's your humble host, Peter B. Collins.
Thanks for downloading and listening to this special podcast, released on the 50th Earth Day. We open with my old pal, Dave Mason.
Things could be lazy if they were so crazy. And I wasn't following you. Running in circles won't find me no purpose. It's right here with you.
And I just realized that this song is 50 years old. It's from the Dave Mason collection that was issued in limited editions with the marble vinyl.
Changes of season, an alias bathing us, watching the changes in you.
Today on Earth Day, I want to do something a little different, because all across the globe, people are safe in their homes, at least we hope so. And our ability to go out and enjoy the outdoors and the spectacle of nature is sharply curtailed. And this podcast is not aimed at my usual audience who listens for political commentary. It's aimed at families everywhere. And joining me is Carlene Cullen. She and her husband, Jeff, founded Cool the Earth, a nonprofit dedicated to helping stop global warming, and they have many innovative education programs aimed at elementary school students and above to educate them on the way boomers have really spoiled the earth. In some ways, we are frying it. Carlene Cullen, thank you for being with me today.
Thanks so much.
So I want to begin because you have a whole program that is going to debut on Earth Day, and it's aimed at the K to 5 audience, that's kindergarten through fifth grade. And I think that it is just perfectly timed to provide interesting entertainment and education, especially for the younger people who are squirming after weeks of home confinement. So we'll learn about your organization, and I want to get some of your own comments on the situation addressing climate change. But you have put together a package that allows people to listen to audio programs that are aimed at young people, and it enables them to learn while scoring points in a way to adopt a polar bear. And I think this is fascinating, and I've listened to a couple of the episodes, and they are animated. You use characters to deliver important messages. So set us up for this. Where did you come up with this idea, and tell us how people can participate?
Sure, thank you. Well, so I started Cool the Earth about 13 years ago, and my target audience were the ones who could barely reach the dinner table. It was the kindergartners through fifth grade. You know, my kids were in elementary school at that point, and when I became aware of climate change and wanted to do something about it, my first audience was adults and saying, you know, here's a huge problem we can do something about. But largely, it fell on deaf ears. If they were concerned about the issue, that might be the case. But their actions really were not compatible with their concerns. So I started thinking about young kids and about how they're going to be inheriting this planet from us and everything that we're leaving behind with it. And, you know, I wrote a play with these characters, with polar bears and the villainous Mr. Carbon and Mother Nature, and created a story that kids could really relate to and that they learned, and they were super excited to help the polar bears, and they really started to understand carbon dioxide. You know, you could ask a first grader about carbon dioxide. And, you know, people, parents, teachers in the beginning were kind of concerned that, gosh, climate change, it was so new 13 years ago, people were concerned that teaching kids about it would actually make them depressed or upset.
Well, and I would also imagine that some people accused you of attempting to brainwash kids.
Oh, my gosh. So we got picked up fairly early on by the Drudge Report. So, yes. So the story was in our local paper, and I got a call from the Wall Street Journal. And the reporter there wanted to talk about kids and how we speak with them about global warming. And it was pretty fascinating. The story in the Wall Street Journal went out basically to talk about how if your kids were exposed to this, what sorts of therapies, what sort of play therapy or talk therapy you could help them get through what they were exposed to about global warming, and really about that we shouldn't be talking with kids about this issue. So it's a very negative story, and the Drudge Report ended up picking it up, and I actually got personal threats against myself and my family from various people, and lots of really contentious sorts of things, you know, saying we are indoctrinating in Hitler videos and all sorts of things. That was a little bit of a tough time for a few years and going through this. Even at schools, we'd have parents who would want the program shut down. In different states, the program would get shut down. And but fundamentally, these kids, they learned about global warming, and most importantly, they weren't afraid, they were empowered. We empowered these little kids, just like Smokey the Bear did, and just like campaigns to not smoke cigarettes. Those all came through children learning and then giving them the tools to go home and talk to their parents, and that's exactly what we've been doing. So when this pandemic hit, I decided, well, we can't be at the schools. What if we kind of made a rapid shift and create these animated stories about Coda, this adorable little polar bear, whose mom, you know, went out hunting but didn't return, and there weren't enough ice floes. And it's not explicitly clear what happened to her, but she didn't return. And Mother Nature is there to help Coda, and the way the kids can help is by pledging to take actions to reduce their carbon footprint and working with their parents as well and making pledges to do that. And when they do, we're going to adopt a polar bear. Our nonprofit's going to make a donation to the World Wildlife Fund, and we're going to be helping to restore the habitat for the polar bears.
And I think this is just a really great concept. Let's listen to an episode of Coda, and people will understand what you are doing. Here we go.
Chapter 3, Finding a Home for Coda. Coda is sad and is missing his mama. Mother Nature wonders, will the humans be willing to help Coda and all the polar bears? Mr. Carbon says,
no way! Sorry, Miss Natural. The humans love fossil fuels. They especially love their gasoline cars. They like it hot.
Coda and Mother Nature decide to write a list of things humans could do to help. Coda reads,
kids can turn off their lights and computers when they're not in use. They can walk or bike or bus to school like I do. Parents can use a bike or an e-bike to get around. And if they drive, they can drive an electric car. These actions would help so much.
Mr. Carbon says,
listen, little Coda, the humans will never do the things you want.
Coda asks,
Mother Nature, do you think the humans will help?
Mother Nature replies, Oh, Coda, you are such a sweet young cub. When the humans find out you've lost your ice, I just know they will help. They'll do lots of things, like get their power from the sun and the wind, and use it for their homes and cars. Coda thanks Mother Nature for being such a good friend. And he asks,
Humans, can I count on you to find me a home and cool the Earth?
Kids, will you take action to help the Earth and to help adopt Coda? Watch the next video with a parent or other adult and pledge to take action together.
So that's one of the episodes of Coda. And let me clarify, this is audio and video, Carlene?
That's correct. It's audio and video, mm-hmm. Simple animation of the characters and as they make their way through the Arctic, yeah.
And am I speaking to the voice talent who did both parts?
I did not do the voiceover. I wrote the script, but we had a friend do the voiceovers for us.
And can we give her credit? Who is she?
Yeah, actually, it's a friend of a friend, so I don't even know her name.
Oh, okay.
But if I did, I'll get back to you on that.
All right. Yeah. Well, I think it's very well executed, and I always like to give creative people the credit they deserve. So do let me know, and I'll include that in the text, the show file that accompanies this podcast. Now, I have to say, when the character Mr. Carbon entered the picture, it made me think of Mr. Burns on The Simpsons, the evil guy who runs the nuclear power plant and his, the greediest character in that show.
Yes. Yeah, you know, it's interesting because with Mr. Carbon, we make fine points in the assembly and in this that we need some carbon dioxide, but that he's so greedy he wants the whole Earth to be filled with carbon dioxide. And I think that, you know, those are those educational nuances that we get across with the kids, that he just wants too much of this. The kids love to, to really scream at Mr. Carbon and say, no, go away. And, it's really a very simple story of good versus evil, protecting people and animals that, smaller people and animals that need some help. And kids really relate to it. And they get, they understand in the simplest of ways that this is a situation that we are causing and that we can fix. And it's, compared to adults who start thinking about their pocketbooks or about political situations or what they might have to sacrifice, kids just go in for it. And they just say, this is what we need to do. And they don't view things as a sacrifice. For them, carrying a reusable water bottle, it's what they've grown up to do. My daughter, who's now 18, who started driving at 16, and she's never driven a gas car. Mm-hmm. And so for her, when she borrowed a friend's car at college and had to get gas, she had to FaceTime me to ask me how to use the gas pump because she had never used it. She thought it was the most disgusting experience she'd ever had, and the smell of the gasoline, et cetera. So it's really getting to these kids when they're young and then having them influence their parents. I hear all the time from parents. We get letters written in saying how they were taking a shower and their child is knocking on the door saying, it's been 7 minutes, it's time to get out. Or kids who are a little bit older are saying, I'm not going to drive in a gas car with you, Mom and Dad. I'll take the bus, I'll walk and bike, but I'm not getting into another gasoline vehicle. And that's the sort of power of youth.
Yeah, indeed. And just to be fair, and I'll inject a little politics here, and you're free to agree or disagree, but, we're leaving a pretty negative legacy to our children. And we've created a new normal of perpetual war, of massive surveillance, of capitalist dominance that just flatly not only ignores but denies the risk to the planet from warming. And there is so much widespread evidence from the wildfires we've endured here in California, also in Australia, the extreme weather events, including hurricanes year after year, flooding in the Midwest United States and across the world. And so to offer awareness and to empower young people, I think is in some ways a last hope, because we've really screwed things up pretty badly.
Yes, absolutely. And I think it just goes well beyond the issue of climate change. So when these kids learn about climate change and are empowered, and they develop a persona, a view of themselves as people who are active citizens, who are empowered to make change. They understand they can make change. They understand also that we all have individual responsibility, but we're all in a community together. So it's very much reminiscent of this pandemic, that people, you know, adults tend to think, oh, you know, this is some global issue, and a global issue about climate change and economic disparity, all these, you know, big issues, but they don't feel like they have any personal responsibility to take action. And I think the pandemic is starting to show that people, you know, start to understand that their individual behavior does matter, and kids get that right away, so the adults are really catching up. And I think that, yes, this generation, we see these kids that we've been, you know, working with since they were in first grade or, you know, eighth grade, and they're going off to college, and they're studying environmental science, and they're really understanding that this is, we are all in a big community, and we all have to take individual action. And a lot of them are giving their parents a hard time about it, because, you know, it's impossible to say, even though people do, but you have to have this sort of cognitive dissonance that I'm so concerned about the fires, the wildfires, yet my gasoline car is by far the number one contributor to carbon emissions, and the fires are being fueled by climate change and carbon emissions. So you can't really continue to say that I'm so concerned about climate change, and yet I'm not reducing my individual carbon footprint. And it's tough for an adult to call another adult out on that, but when the kids can say very black and white, this is not the way you can behave, you're destroying my planet and my future, then adults start to listen.
And let me ask you a specific question here about the K through 5 group. And Greta Thunberg has emerged as a real leader, and she's still, what, only 18 years old, maybe she's 19 now. And we know that the reception by adults is mixed depending on their bias. I think she is widely embraced by teenagers. But what kind of feedback do you get from K through 5 kids? Are they aware of her, and do they see her as an icon?
So I would say there's not a high degree of awareness with the very young.
Mm-hmm.
With the kids who are in 5th and 6th grades, they tend to have more of an awareness. She has a book out that's addressing that target audience, and they're starting to learn, even maybe 4th grade. And for them, she is an absolute hero. She's a hero in so many ways. She's a hero. She's a climate change hero. She's a hero, heroine who, you know, has stood up to adults, who has spoken her mind, who's articulate and passionate. And, you know, she's somebody that many of them really look up to. And I think she'll be a leader for this group for many years.
We're talking with Carlene Cullen. She is a founder of Cool the Earth. You can find them on the web at cooltheearth.org. And we have been discussing so far the Earth Day program that I encourage parents to check out and share with your children. I think that it's fascinating and entertaining, and a good way to observe Earth Day indoors this year. Carlene, tell us a little more about Cool the Earth. You've told us that it is primarily an educational effort, and that it is aimed at very young people. How did this originate, and how did you decide to focus on this target group?
Sure. so I, in the 80s, my background is in the 80s, I started a medical and scientific information technology company with my brother that we grew and eventually became a global company, and it was very successful, and it had direct impact, positive impact on patient mortality around the world in hospitals. So, and I had had some early experiences with starting that company where I had seen that one individual action can actually make a difference. In Zimbabwe, I got a call from a medical librarian one time in the middle of the night saying they needed information and their computer servers were down. So I went into our database, found the information, and we saved a farmer's life. And, you know, that meant so much to have that one situation that impacted another human. And when my kids were in kindergarten and first grade, and I became aware of climate change when I was watching an Al Gore's An Inconvenient Truth. I always say that was the worst date of my life. My husband took me on a date night, and he wanted to see that film, and it really changed our lives.
Well, it was deadly PowerPoint on a big screen, but it had quite an impact.
The thing that captured me was really not the science. It was really the personal story, which is that when our son was two, he nearly died, and he was in the hospital for weeks from an infectious disease that they couldn't treat. And 6 years later, 4 years later, we're in the theater watching Al Gore's film, and people don't remember oftentimes that he shared how he nearly lost his son, and he sat by his bedside for a month while his son, you know, they weren't sure if he was going to make it. And we had had that parallel experience several years before. And I just sat sobbing in the theater, but walked out and was resolved to say, you know, I know what it's like to feel and to nearly lose everything you've ever cared about. And we all feel that way about our children. And I just, you know, committed my life at that point to trying to stop global warming and climate change, because if every parent had gone through the experience we had gone through of this near loss and the trauma of that, there would be a different approach towards our behaviors and realizing that what we're doing is the setup for the future for our kids and everything that we care about. So I started this, and my kids were young, and I thought, you know, let's start talking with the young kids about it, because it's going to be their future. And that's how it all began.
And Carlene, aside from the right-wing blowback and being attacked by Matt Drudge, what have been some of the high points of this work? Where do you feel that you really connected and, you know, kind of honed your communications strategy as you have?
Yeah. Well, so when I had parents... When I had parents stop me at school, because we started with my children's school, and tell me about all the different ways that they had changed their energy consumption at home, all because of their children, and that their children would just come home and talk about things, and that the children were almost like little police. So Stanford University did a year-long evaluation of the program, which is really about behavior change, as energy and behavior change. And there, you know, time and again, the parents would say how the children were monitors in the household, or they were the guards keeping care that the heat wasn't too high, or that they were composting, et cetera. And whenever I'd hear stories like that from parents, or reading about stories from the parents talking about how the kids have taken over their habits around anything around energy, food waste, et cetera, that to me is just golden.
Well, Carlene, let me ask you about your views of the current situation, because there was some momentum generated by the left progressives, including Bernie Sanders, to embrace a kind of a vague idea of a Green New Deal. And it was vague because the rest of the Democratic Party was wary of it being used to defeat them in elections, primarily. I think it was their self-interest. Even people in elected office who have a strong awareness of climate change fear it as a policy position. And, you know, they've always dismissed that, oh, gosh, you know, a Green New Deal would just cost too much. But, you know, the state of the decline of the planet due to carbon emissions and other factors that are warming the Earth, we've just had, what, the fifth year of bleaching of the Great Barrier Reef. I'm a scuba diver, and, you know, that really hits hard to me to see us destroying sea life. And pretty blithe about it. The decline and extinction of species accelerates, some estimate at the rate of 150 species a day. And so we see a real lack of political will, and the excuse is often, well, it would just cost too much, and so it's dismissed at that point. But, you know, in response to the pandemic, we have just borrowed from our kids some $6 trillion total, and there will be more. And I believe that that's going to be used to slam the door on any costly efforts to address the damage that we've done. What's your view?
Yeah, well, that's a big question. I believe the number one thing we can do is get a carbon tax on everything that we consume or generate in the United States. And I think that that is by far the greatest opportunity, the best economic driver. But how do we get to a carbon tax, which is part of the New Deal? How do we get to a carbon tax? Well, we first of all need to get voters to vote, and we need to vote out not only climate deniers, but we also need to vote out Democrats who are still supporting their fossil fuel industry in their state. So they're talking out of both sides of their mouths, and I think that this is an essential thing that we have to really approach both sides. It's not just a Republican issue. It is largely a Republican issue, but there are still Democrats in you know, oil producing and you know, fracking states that are still supporting.
Yes, there are.
And that's a problem. You know, I read something recently and I fully embraced it, which is that while oil prices are so low and the prices of the pump are so low, now is the time to institute a carbon tax. It would barely be noticed by the consumer, if at all. Some places it's 99 cents a gallon for gasoline. If there was a carbon tax, we could implement it now before prices go back up, and then it would be just embedded as part of the price. And if we had a Congress and a president who actually cared about climate change, we could do something like that. Even, you know, in this dire time, it would be just like the perfect opportunity. So I think the other thing I think is that, you know, I'm so tired of people blaming the government for the issue. And, you know, we as consumers, we have so much power. When you look at Fox News and what happened to the various personalities that got taken down when we all stopped buying certain products, we had boycotts on certain products, and we said we're not going to buy those advertisers' products if they continue on the Bill O'Reilly show to advertise, et cetera. That's it. We as consumers can really make a difference here. And people don't realize with gasoline, 42% of all the petroleum products produced in the United States are for our gas-powered vehicles, and that's mostly consumer passenger vehicles. So imagine, just imagine, if we all made our next car electric, we gave our money to the solar and wind industries, and 42% of the petroleum products, there was no longer demand, we would see a collapse of the oil prices. We would see the lobby for the oil industry go away or diminish greatly, and we would see that lobbying effect, you know, really lighten on our Congress, and we'd be able to have policies that we all care about. But, you know, consumers matter, and what we choose to spend our money on really matters.
Well, and the response to the pandemic, I think will ultimately be called a depression worldwide, has put enormous pressure on the oil industry. Fracking is only profitable at $60 a barrel for crude or higher. And even, you know, our domestic production without fracking is at a break-even point somewhere around $40 a barrel. And we've seen it drop below 20 on the world market and into the low $20 range here in the United States just in recent weeks. And I recently interviewed Scott Ritter. He's best known as a former UN's weapons inspector who said there weren't any WMD in Iraq and was ignored. But he is a former intelligence officer, and he characterizes the situation with this battle between Russia and Saudi Arabia as an effort that is going to be long term, and it is going to make fracking unprofitable for at least gasoline products. And so this could be a silver lining in the suffering that many people are enduring right now. And it could also parallel with what you describe as consumer action to reduce the demand and force them to really explore other ways to stay in business. Have you seen, pardon me, have you seen any analysis along that line? And what does it mean to you?
I have read quite a bit about it, and, you know, unfortunately for people's livelihoods in oil-producing states and in the refineries, et cetera, I think there's going to be collapse, because I view this as just Putin, well, this I think was orchestrated by Putin, and this was basically a power play to squeeze out American producers, because, you know, the Saudis and Russia can sustain their oil production for quite a while, but basically the American economics of the American fracking, it can't be sustained. So what looked to many to be a real benefit to fracking was to have what they energy independence. I put that in quotation marks.
Mm-hmm.
There is no independent oil market. It's a global market. And it's a complete misnomer to think that America is energy independent because we drill for oil here. I know we're a net exporter of oil now, but there's going to be an American collapse, and it would be, I think, explicitly clear to government and consumers that we do not have the power, and the only real energy independence is from the sun and the wind, and to have it produced, manufactured, installed, maintained on American soil. That's the way we really gain energy independence. Otherwise, we are forever just completely at the risk of whatever Putin or the Saudis want to do next.
Well, I agree with that, and I think it returns to your earlier comment that it becomes political. And as this predicted collapse plays out, I think that we need to block the re-election or election of people who are likely to support a bailout of the oil patch. Mm-hmm. And they already receive, you know, incredible subsidies. it's been their influence in Washington has been remarkable and consistently greedy. And members of both parties have bowed to it for decades. And so we need a real seismic shift in those attitudes to prevent, intervention, this kind of corporate welfare, the socialization of corporate losses from being repeated.
Yes, yes. Yeah, wholeheartedly. I mean, the oil subsidies and it's so simple in so many ways, right? We buy the product, they take the money, and they turn around and lobby there. They get their people elected, and then they lobby like hell, right? The big oil is in the top five lobbies in the United States. And it's no wonder Trump just rolled back the mileage standards. Barely anybody has been looking during this pandemic. California and I think it's 12 other states are going to fight it and going to, it's going to go maybe possibly to the Supreme Court. But I can tell you that I worked for over a year on Governor Newsom's team when he was running for governor, and I worked on his electrification of transportation and policy committee. And, you know, he is very strong anti-oil and pro-climate, and California is going to fight this to the end.
Well, I want to thank you for joining us today, Carlene. Is there anything you'd like to add before we wrap up?
No, but thank you very much. This was really great to discuss while I sit in my office day in, day out. You know, so it's great to have this conversation.
All right. And the videos will be available on Earth Day. And you can also reach out to cooltheearth.org at info@cooltheearth.org. They're available in English and Spanish. And it sounds like you can give advance access to groups and organizations who might share this as part of their Earth Day observance?
Exactly. Yes, we're putting it out there. And you can go to the website now and sign up. It's all free. We're just looking to get the program out there and give kids something fun and empowering to do on Earth Day.
Carlene Cullen, thank you very much for joining us.
Thank you, Peter.
Thanks for listening to this in-depth interview with Carlene Cullen. Send your comments to peter@peterbcollins.com.
Happy trails to you until we meet again. Happy trails to you. Keep smiling.